Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is Scott Kainz, the CEO of Corsel PLC. How are you doing, Scott? It's good to have you back on the podcast.
Doing well. Great to be here again.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I know we spoke to you not so long ago, and it's good to be catching up again. And of course, we have Kenny joining us as usual.
Yep. How are we doing, Scott?
Good to see you guys again.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like a lifetime ago when we done that Market Musings Podcast. It was probably, it's been 10 months ago, I think.
Yeah, time flies, especially during COVID, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's just COVID, a weird reality we all exist in right now.
Yeah, COVID seems to have accelerated time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm accelerating faster than the age of 50.
I think we're all feeling it a little bit, indeed.
Yeah, definitely. But it's good. It's good to have you back on. And obviously, Corsel has been pretty busy. It's not been resting on its laurels during this COVID period. So
no.
So what is out there for investors to get excited about in the world of Corsel?
That's exactly it. I mean, I think we wanted to come back on because we have had some big announcements of late. And in particular, we've acquired a couple of FGS assets, two big peaker plants. One is a 50 megawatt gas peaker at Tring Road, where we have 40%. And the other is a 50 megawatt gas peaker at Avonmouth, where we have 100%. And you know, I think there was some questions around how quickly can the Corsel team bulk up the FGS portfolio. And I think we've now proven that we can do that. And, you know, we've got multiple projects now at shovel ready stage where we can get on, fund them, and, you know, move on to taking development fees and ongoing revenue from those projects.
Yeah. And that's four plants in total now, Scott.
Yeah, so we've got the two peakers, we've got a battery plant, and then we've got an option on another 15 megawatts. So you could look at it as a 3+1 sort of situation.
Yeah. Yes.
And that really doesn't include anything else in the portfolio, which I can't really go into too much detail about. I mean, we are trying to wait till we get these things to pretty advanced stage before we publicly talk about them. I think that was probably one of our, you know, earlier mistakes, you might say, that we were, because this was a new part of our business, we were talking about things that were fairly early. And the nice thing about as you get farther down the road is you can really just focus on the meat potatoes, and you don't have to lift the curtain on the portfolio and the pipeline any earlier than you need to. But I can assure you that, you know, behind these projects, there's a few things, a number of things, in fact, kind of percolating.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, Mark, I'm just going to say, I mean, for my benefit probably as well, because I don't know a great deal about gas peaker plants, and I'm sure there's probably a few investors as well that are not scratching their head, but just curious, you know, where does the sort of gas peaker plants fit into the energy mix, and what are they?
Well, I was going to say National Grid would tell you that natural gas is crucial to energy supplies, especially, you know, until about 2050, so 25, 30 plus years. And so, you know, a lot of people have said, well, why are you guys getting into gas peakers when you're doing batteries? Aren't they the sexier, more green type thing? And they probably are, as sort of on one level. But, you know, our view is that these peakers are going to be around for, as I said, another 30 plus years. Typical lifespan is about 25 years. And so we really want to be in both. You know, we want to be in industrial grid size batteries. And we believe that these gas peaker plants, which effectively smooth out renewables, I mean, that's what they do. They run some of the time, but not all the time. So, for example, when the wind doesn't blow, they turn on and run a couple hours and smooth out everybody's kind of dinner making at the end of the day or things like that. So as we put more renewables on the grid, these gas peakers are more and more important. And the key to them is flexibility, the fact that they can turn on and off within 2 minutes. And if you look at other technologies out there, like big gas, you know, combined cycle gas engines, for example, they take a long time to turn on. And we all know how long a nuclear plant takes to spin up, you know, for example. So these other sorts of things just can't perform this function. And so, you know, as we looked at the market, we said, this is the kind of gas that's going to be last off the grid. And so as much as, you know, we may all hope that it's just wind and solar from here on out, it's just not likely to be the case. And even on the battery side, I mean, most batteries installed in the UK run for 1 hour or less at this point, whereas these peakers can run, you know, as long as you have gas supplies, really. So you can certainly see how they sort of fit in the mix. And so we think that there's going to be ongoing demand for these small scale connected gas peaker plants that, you know, that are going to play this kind of important role as things move forward.
So they're basically, they complement the battery storage.
I would say they complement renewables. So they really complement solar and wind. Battery storage fits into that as well and offers a little bit more because you can buy, you know, electricity off the grid. So say our Burwell project, when it's up and running, for example, will be able to take excess power off the grid. That's something the peaker can't do. So you can certainly see how the batteries offer a, an interesting kind of trading angle there. Mm. As you buy when it's cheap, sometimes you get paid to take it offline. Mm. So if the wind blows too much, the national grid will pay you to take electricity out of the system. Peakers are more input only, obviously. I mean, that's how they work, gas in, electricity out. But again, you know, looking at COVID, for example, COVID has reduced overall demand, prices have fallen. And so a lot of that baseload has come off, especially carbon heavy baseload like coal. I'm sure you guys noted, you know, a few days, well, actually been more than that, where coal has not been a part of the UK energy mix. And so what happens is that really throws us up against it. It's really renewables at that point. And if those stop, if, for example, the sun starts blocking solar panels around the UK, you can imagine you can have a very quick drop in power. And so what do you need? You need gas peakers like this that can turn on in 2 minutes and sort of smooth those things out. So as we move to renewables, these things become more and more important. Okay. And that was, you know, the sort of opportunity I think we identified. We'd like both. We'd like to continue to develop a portfolio of batteries, but there seems to be real money to be made in these transition and support installations as well.
Okay. And they are literally sort of gas turbines that turn on and off to meet demand as and when needed.
Correct. You get a gas connection in on one side. You get a bunch of these different engines. They're almost like marine gas turbines. That's right. And some, you know, you can different sizes and different efficiencies. But the big difference in what we're doing really is that these current installations are 40x% efficient. And that what that really means is they're designed to run. Whereas a lot of the original gas peakers installed around the UK were kind of cheap and cheerful. People were just putting, I mean, no offense, but kind of junk out there, effectively making sure or implying that it was never going to run. They were getting what's called capacity market payments for that. And you really never wanted to turn them on. Whereas what we're talking about here is kind of a gas peaker 2.0, where really we want them to run and we intend to make money by running them, certainly a bit more than some of these traditional gas peakers that are out there.
Mm-hmm. And just go on, Kenny, and I'll let you come in.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is there subsidies available for these new sort of 2.0?
There are. There are subsidies available for everything. The real question is how much does it get reduced? So, for example, the capacity market is the big one. Batteries, for example, can play in that market. But again, because they can only run for an hour to 2 hours, something like that, they get derated. And so their subsidy is sort of 40%, 30% of the full amount. So you can see that's not a great place for batteries to play. Whereas these gas peakers, they get 100%. They get the entire government subsidy. I think it's 98.9% or something like that, but you get the idea. The point is that the government, the national grid looks at that and said, well, those gas peakers are going to run. They're going to run for hours and they're going to be available when you need it. Whereas a battery, it kind of depends. It kind of depends on obviously where the trading is at that point. Maybe they just sold their, expended their battery out and they don't have anything available. But whereas gas is just consistent, as long as we have gas supplies around the UK, you see these things playing. So the idea, the way a capacity market works is effectively you get a notice period. I think they give you about 4 hours and then you've got to turn on if they tell you to. And really, it's only happened once. It's only one time in 2016 that's been implemented. But you get paid to sort of sit there regardless. And that's kind of how you can see that, you know, there was a little bit of laziness historically where people would put kind of engines that really were never designed to be run in there. So we're trying to sort of change that dynamic a little bit.
So do you think that just on the FGS, which is Flexible Grid Solutions, do you think that's, well, maybe you can explain the concept a bit first and then tell me what you think about the future. Is it the future of energy, do you think?
Yeah, well, FGS was set up some years ago to for Corcel to play in this space. And again, our mandate is really solar grid level energy storage and these gas peakers at this point. And yeah, no, it's become one of our focus areas, I think, in part because it's been easier to advance under COVID. I mean, we're here in the UK. We've been able to do deals with a couple of really exciting partners, including Arlington Energy and Electric Land. These are experienced groups in the area. They want exposure through the PLC. And often in this case, they've got projects that they're willing to sort of work with us to vend into the PLC or vend into some of our subs in some cases. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we'd always seen this as balancing the mining assets where we're offering exposure to battery metals in the ground. But certainly during COVID, this has become one of our primary focuses. And maybe that's normal with the inability to travel and do some of the overseas mining stuff that we might want to do. It's been easier in a sense to move some of these different energy projects forward. And I'd say at this point, yeah, I mean, it's looking like probably, one of the more exciting near-term opportunities in our portfolio. We're looking to go to financial close on Tring Road and Avonmouth here by September or so. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we would hope to get some pretty big development fees. I mean, you'd be looking at a total development fee at Avonmouth of up to $1.5 million. And our 40%, if you do the same thing at Tring, would be something like 600,000. So, I mean, it's real money for a company of our size, not to mention the fact that we would hope to get an ongoing carry. And we, of course, have the opportunity to invest ourselves. So, I mean, the idea here is that these things are funded at the SPV level and that Corcel or FGS may take a percent and certainly would end up with a free carry of some kind as well. So you can see you sort of dip in it, you know, across a couple different angles there. Mm-hmm.
And on a national level, like a government national level, is this how the government, do you feel the UK government feel that is a solution to energy in the future rather than building huge, you know, nuclear power plants, for example?
Very much. I mean, I think energy security is sort of, you know, it goes hand in hand with what they call climate security. And so as we move towards net zero 2050, they've got to find a way to get there. And that's kind of what I was trying to say. You look at what's going to fall off first and what's going to be built, and gas basically will be the last fossil fuel off the market. And in particular, those big gas plants will go off the market before gas peakers. And so when we're sitting here looking about putting the CapEx together for one of these projects, and we're saying, you know, what does it look like? What does the regulatory environment look like over the next 25, 30 years? It looks pretty good. It looks like these high efficiency peakers will be around with us for quite some time yet. And so they make good investments. And, when they do run, which again is not all the time, they can make pretty serious money as well. So again, I think we see this as dovetailing perfectly with what the government says it wants to do with the increase of renewables, with carbon baseload coming off, with few nuclear plants likely being built anytime soon. You need sort of efficiency. You need these flexible assets, and some of that's going to be batteries and longer duration batteries, but a lot of it is going to be these gas peakers, and that's why we found them attractive to get into.
Okay. So kind of small peaker plants across the country almost.
Quite, exactly. Yeah. Rather than build some massive multi-billion pound station, you know, on the coast somewhere, you build a number of these smaller sort of 50 megawatt type peakers around the country, a little closer to where your needs are.
Yeah, okay.
And they turn on and off as required. It's sort of an elegant solution. And I think, you know, again, judging by what the government and National Grid have said, it's very important to really moving towards, you know, dealing with climate change and adjusting the way the UK uses energy and generates energy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before, Scott, about batteries only being, what, about 2 hours? Is that just a technology at the moment?
You can build more. It's just that we haven't. Other countries have done it. So the UK has tended to install 1 hour duration battery. So what that means is if you've got a 50 megawatt battery, it can pull it out 50 megs for 1 hour.
Okay.
But you can see that's not all that much. I mean, what if we have a real series of brownouts or blackouts or some sort of major calamity of some kind? That's not going to get you too far. And so that's where these fossil fuel flexible assets. I mean, again, a gas peaker can run for hours and hours and hours with no problem at all.
Okay.
Now, new battery installations are going a little higher, and that's one of the things we're looking at with Burwell. I think Burwell is likely to end up higher than 1 hour, and really what that means is just putting extra cells in.
It's just
basically more CapEx, and to date people haven't seen, or investors haven't seen, a reason to do that, but I think that's now changing.
And from Corcel's point of view, is it easy enough for you to kind of be flexible in that regard, you know, in the future you can put more cells in, perhaps take gas speakers offline if needs be?
Yeah, you can. You can certainly, you could do a refresh of your battery at some point and make it a 1.5 hour or 2 hour battery at some stage. But you're not going to do that, obviously, since you have a certain amount of wear and tear on the cells that are already there. So that's probably a 10 or 12 or 13 year kind of point. I don't think anybody would do it. You wouldn't do it in year four, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But yeah, we've seen some flexibility with the peakers as well. There have been some diesel peakers that have been set up over the years, and there's some plan, or I've seen some groups that have been looking to convert them to gas, for example. But again, these diesels, I think, are much the same way. They were largely intended just to take capacity market revenue, to take some of those guaranteed fixed revenues and really never turn on. So again, it's a slightly different sort of thing. I would call that more that 1.0 stuff where it's safe and investors liked it, but there's really very little upside. There's not a lot of trading in it because you're really just sitting there taking government payments. And so it certainly appealed at the time. But I think, you know, people in the industry see this as a changing space. And I think you're going to need to operate to play at this point. You're not going to be able to just sit there, collect and make returns maybe it was possible 5-7 years ago.
Sure. And where is Corcel now then with the projects that you've got? You've got quite a few, haven't you?
Yeah. So again, across the three, we're at shovel ready on Tring and Avonmouth, and we're moving to financial close straight away. So, you know, starting really last week, we've kind of started to package these deals. And one point I would make, people have said, well, why are you doing so much at one time? And really the reason is because it's easier. It's easier to market 100 megawatts of gas than it is to market seven, for example. You know, we've seen a few competitors pop up on AIM, for example, with some of these small plants. And frankly, you know, it's just difficult. Right, because you have to do all the same work. It's all the same marketing. It's all the same sort of prep and approvals and planning and everything. So why not sort of go big, I think, at that point? And when it comes to talking to investors around the city, investors tend to want to write reasonable size checks. I mean, certainly if you want to play with the bigger boys, right? So we really see this as now it's a 50 plus 50, 100 megawatt gas peaker joint group of assets. It's going to be marketed really starting immediately. We've really already started in a sense. And, you know, the idea would be to try to look to find a group to do potentially a large chunk of it. And then if not, obviously you can open it up to sort of a wider section, but having 100 megawatts, I think makes it more likely that we're going to get some big investors in there who may just do all of it or nearly all of it or something along those lines.
Okay. And it's a bit, go on, Kenny, sorry.
Yeah, it's a bit of going to the pub. And it's easy to have four shots in the one go than it is to have one shot in the one go. You're drinking rapid. So, no, I get your theory.
The battery is something different. The other point you see is when you're talking to investors is there's kind of a silo of investors that kind of look at it the way we look at it. They want to be in peakers. Then there's the silo of investors who want to be super green and they won't touch any carbon. And we think that's a little unrealistic. That's kind of what I was trying to say. I mean, it's nice to say that. It makes you feel good. It's good on your annual report or whatever. But the reality is we have to have both. And so it makes sense to sort of put a package of peakers together, market it to, you know, investor X, that group, and then to do your battery stuff a little bit independently because they're going to be slightly different silos there.
Is it sort of waste energy a route that you guys have looked at all?
We have looked at that. I mean, that's a little bit different animal simply because it has a lot of engineering and complicated feedstock. You know, you think about those plants, you've got to get that feedstock right. And securing feedstock over sort of 25, 30 years can be tricky because it can change. You know, it's just difficult. So that's not something we're as focused on. I think there's been a lot of kind of high level, I mean, it's something we've looked at, but there's been a lot of high level failures in the UK over the last 10 years where, you know, a lot of those plants were built and had to be rebuilt and redone. It just seems to have a level of complexity to it. You know, it looks attractive and everybody says, let's turn our waste into energy. Great, great plan, right? But I just think it's a little bit trickier. This stuff is sort of elegant because gas is gas, right? I mean, you're just using bog standard natural gas. All you need is a pipeline in and that's it. There's really no risk around feedstock whatsoever. And prices tend to move together. So, I mean, if natural gas goes up, energy tends to move in parallel. So that, you know, the idea that you would never, you know, you should always be able to capture a margin or a spread on these kind of things. And that gives us good comfort that they're going to be economic for quite some time. Okay. So we're kind of getting out there. Like I said, idea is to really move these first two through to financial close as soon as possible. And obviously we'll update the market once that's done. Our Burwell project is lagging a little bit behind. We're sort of moving that to shovel ready up there. Our landowner has been looking to sell his land and that's kind of slowed things down it's a little bit outside of our control. So we're kind of waiting for him to finish his land sale. We've been in discussions with some of the potential buyers of that land. And I think we're pretty comfortable that the field for which this is planned will be a battery site because it's in everybody's obvious economic interest for that to happen. But unfortunately, it's a little bit out of our control if the individual in question wants to exit his property and he's going to do that first before somebody commits to our battery. But the good thing is we're working on planning and some other bits in the background. And we're hoping for have really planning advanced here pretty much to be finished, in the next month or so, basically. So I think Burwell is at a point where we'd like to be able to announce shovel ready status on that in the near term. And then, as I said earlier, move that to financial close, probably on a slightly different schedule, as I mentioned, simply because it will be a different group of investors there.
And when you say financial close, Scott, that means what? That's you're ready to get investment and effectively build.
Yeah, you're effectively funding the SPV with a mix of debt and equity. And how much of that you get depends obviously on the type of project. The nice thing about peakers, again, is that banks understand them, right? And these debt providers understand them. So it's actually a little bit easier to get debt into peakers than it is to batteries. Although I think that's changing with everybody now getting pretty excited about batteries. That may be a little easier than it used to be. But a typical leverage ratio would be sort of 50-50. And you sort of, you know, you work out the returns to equity holders on that basis. And the returns are pretty good. I mean, these projects should be making in the double digits. And obviously, you know, at some point you might refinance them. So you might have a sort of construction finance piece of debt that gets refinanced out after a couple of years, because at that point the risk's all gone, right? I mean, once the plant's built, it's just, it's easy to get sort of very cheap debt. So, so it's, you know, the investor return profiles look attractive to us, and we're pretty, you know, pretty excited to sort of move that forward and hopefully to retain, like I said, a pretty decent interest as well as take some debt fees out. So, you know, this looks to be a near term, you know, as we've always hoped it would be, a near term revenue generator for Corcel. And contrasting that with the mining stuff, which we all know can take time. You know, obviously some of these deposits take many years to take to go forward from sort of a greenfield to something that you can either mine or exit in, you know, in various stages.
Yeah, it's a good point as you made, Scott, timely talking about mining. I was just going to ask, obviously there's two strings to the bow at the moment, or there's many strings, but you've got the natural resources side of the business as well.
Indeed.
What's going on there? What can you tell investors?
We've been chugging away in the background on that. You know, if you look at Mumbare, we did announce an environmental permit came out. That's our Papua New Guinea nickel cobalt asset a few weeks ago. And that's a pretty big step. That's basically the last step before a mining lease. Now, of course, it's no guarantee with the PNG government of how long it takes to sort of finish our mining lease. But the value inflection event there is to get the 20, 25 year mining lease. And at that point, you can either go forward and turn that into a DSO operation, or probably you could sell it out, bring a partner in and have them go forward. I mean, certainly we expect there to be quite a bit of demand, but the key there is the mining lease. And so this environmental permit that we announced, as I said, a couple of weeks ago, is probably the second to last step. It's pretty much, you know, we're pretty close. Although again, with the PNG government and COVID actually kind of being a bit of an issue in the country at the moment, you know, we certainly can't really comment on timelines there. But it's definitely trending the right direction. And, you know, again, I always like to highlight this as an asset that underpinned Corcel's predecessor to, I think it was a 40 million pound valuation at one point. So these are big assets. And right now, you know, we continue to not get a lot of sort of value for them, I think, in our market cap. And I would expect that to change. I mean, hopefully, as we move towards mining lease here and people start to see that this project's real and moving to a real value inflection event.
Yeah.
And then... Go ahead.
I mean, I think Mumbare from memory, because I've been involved in Mumbare way back in, what's that, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. I think it's only 3-4% explode.
Yes. I guess it's gigantic. And most of the drilling was done on the side of the hill, effectively, not on the plateau. And that was due to logistical reasons. So no, it's nowhere near close to being drilled out. And I think once you get a mining lease and start to look to go into production on a small part of it, then obviously you open up an exploration campaign to both increase your grade and to drill out the plateau where everybody believes, you know, a large chunk of the DSO will come from over a 20 year plus life. So yeah, no, it's a whopper. It's a big one. You know, and I think it's after a few years of being quiet, some years of nickel not being super hot, I think it's definitely trending in the right direction. And we're definitely, you know, we're looking like we're nearly there. Fingers crossed, I think, on that one, of the PNG government doing what it needs to do. But the good thing is we're aligned with them, and you know, they want to see these projects move forward as well. So I guess the other thing to say is a potential second project there. We have been, and this has taken quite a bit of time with COVID as well, but we've got a rather large debt position in RMI, which is an ASX vehicle that owns a second comparable project to Mumbare called Wowo Gap. We are working with, I think, as we've announced, with RMI now to settle our debt. And, you know, I think we've been reasonably public about the concept that we swapped that debt for the second project. And at that point, I mean, you really become a pretty big regional player, both in PNG, but really probably beyond PNG in the nickel cobalt space. And the idea has always been to potentially combine these operations to save on geologists, to save on logistics, and to use the lessons learned on taking Mumbare through to DSO operation to have Wowo Gap right behind it. And you may over time end up taking ore from both locations and having kind of a similar logistical stream. So I think, you know, I mean, everybody can kind of see how that could make sense over time. So, you know, I think we got involved with Wowo or RMI originally about a year ago, a little over a year ago, and it's taken a long time for the kind of process to move through. But we're very comfortable with our debt position. And if you look at what RMI has been doing, they've picked up a second nickel asset in Africa. And, you know, I think it doesn't take too much intelligence to see that looks like the next lily pad for them to sort of land on. So you can sort of start to see the pieces moving into place. And again, maybe it's taken a little longer than we'd hoped, but that's the nature of these sorts of things. You can't sort of force these things. And RMI has to go through its own little dance with the ASX and kind of its own shareholders and board, obviously. So there's this sort of process that has to play out. But it would not be unreasonable for Corcel to have two rather large nickel projects here in the short term. And again, that will transform us into a pretty big player in the space.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, with the EV revolution and the electrification of everything going on, you know, nickel plays a key role in that sector.
It certainly does. It certainly does. And we just see nickel being used more and more, not just in stainless steel, which is where it's used historically, but in EVs and batteries of different kinds. And I mean, nickel's had a bit of a tough run, and that in part explains why Mumbari has been a bit neglected over the last couple of years. But it all seems to be changing for the positive now. And these kinds of projects in PNG are likely to be attractive alternatives to Chinese groups, for example, that have historically run into some issues in places like Indonesia and the Philippines, where those governments are trying to capture more of the value chain. So we think PNG fits into that mix quite well. And we're excited to kind of see this finally come to a conclusion. Again, it's been a little slower than you hoped, but that's sort of the nature of these things. And I think COVID certainly hasn't helped us with governments being efficient, as we probably all know.
Yeah, I mean, even when you were talking about China there, I mean, there was a start in an article the other day that, you know, obviously the Chinese are leading the world with the EV penetration into the market, but it's still only 6% of the total cars in the market. And there's huge, huge growth in China. I think the States is only like 2%.
It's two or 3%. Yeah, it's tiny. No, I mean, I've been renting electrics for years. In fact, I've got a company down here in central London I use called UFO Drive, I think it is, that I rent when we do rarely need a car, which is not all that often. So for me, it's become normal, but you're totally right. I mean, your average American, your average Chinese, probably your average European as well, really probably hasn't even looked at it seriously yet. You know, so we're just at the beginning of it. And I know there's been a lot of anticipation in markets and some pricing about it, but no, it's only just begun.
Yeah,
I just haven't seen that flow through yet.
I think once the parity, you know, obviously EVs are still dearer than your traditional combustion engines, but I think once that parity between the two of them occurs, then you'll see that switch. And it'll just be a frenzy. I mean, yeah. The EV battery prices are coming down all the time due to technology, you know, etc. So it's there's a definite storm brewing. I mean, personally myself, I'm not even considered at the moment. You know, I've got an old diesel and it just runs. But at some point, we won't have a choice because all these manufacturers are, you know, they're 2025, some of them are 2030, and they're just stopping building.
Yeah. They're just going to shut down. That's right. Yeah. I mean, look at BMW, look at Porsche. I mean, they were a little bit behind Tesla and some of the leaders, but they're catching up quickly here. And if you look at the new Tesla S Plaid, I think that Elon was announcing the other day, and you know, we were talking about parity. It's unbelievable. First, not as unbelievable fast, but the ranges now are getting into the 400 plus mile range. And I think that's exactly the point you're making. I mean, once you have a sedan that'll do 450 miles, there's really not much else to discuss at that point.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the charging, yeah, okay, you got to worry about that stuff. But most people's bladders and you know, need to eat at some point. They're going to give out before 450 miles, right? So I think that's always been the sort of number I had in my head. Once you get above 400, maybe 450 is a good number. Then it is parity at that point. And frankly, it's better than parity because of the tech, I think, that's involved with these things. I mean, if you haven't driven one, I would highly recommend everybody sort of try to get a rental at some point because the technology, I mean, it's like, you know, having a mini supercomputer based in your car. You can play video games, you know, the nav systems will blow away anything that's been out there historically. I mean, it's a very different experience. The instant on all torque, you know, is really addictive. Yeah. It can take a sort of economy car to make it feel really fast, let alone a sports car, right? So no, I was a little bit of a motorhead back in my old days when I lived in Germany, driving on the Autobahn, and you know, it was good fun to sort of rent Porsches and just have a bit of fun here and there, driving 200 kilometers an hour from time to time as you could legally. But I have to say, it didn't take that much to sway me that this is the future. But you really do have to go drive it, because I think a lot of sort of motorhead types in particular say, oh, you know, I want the noise, I want the rumble, I want the V8 or the turbos or whatever they happen to like. And once you go drive one for real, you say, wow, this is like a spaceship, and then this is the future.
Yeah.
You know, I can certainly see that as more consumers get exposed to it, that the numbers start to skyrocket. And when that happens, well, then these raw materials we're talking about are just going to go ballistic. And you know, our strategy has been to pre-position ourselves relatively cheaply. And I think, you know, if you look at something like Whoa Gap, where we know it was very, very little cash on the floor to sort of take that project potentially. I hope that should look like a pretty good deal over the coming months and years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I did test drive a Hyundai Kona a little while ago. And, you know, that's not the quickest of cars, but gee, there was some torque there.
You
put you back in your seat. It's awesome.
All I can say is go try to get a hold of one of the Tesla S's, you know, one of the ones that does 0 to 16, 2.8. I mean, even in a parking lot, I hate to, because, you know, you don't have to put it down for long.
Yeah.
Because it just does not have that rev up and that delay lag that even the best, you know, naturally aspirated turbo engines have. It's just all on when
just
you want
instant,
it.
Instant.
And so it's an addictive sort of thing. And it's quite, you know, very, very handy for traffic and things, you know, if you need to pass or get into a merge or whatever it is. It's clear the future. At some point, gas engine cars will just be something that hobbyists, you know, use.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably with special permits, right? I mean, that's probably how it's going to work out.
Eventually. Yeah. Good. So when is it then, Scott, we're looking at next for Corsair? Sort of autumn time, really. Is that the next kind of milestone point?
Well, I said, I don't want to comment on something like the Mombari. You know, if we go down the list, financial close for the two big peakers, that can happen. We're working on that now. That happens when it happens, right? Mm-hmm. So as soon as you get the investment in place, it happens. I think we've set ourselves a deadline, I would say, like a long stop date of September. So we'd hope to have it done by then.
Okay.
But that could happen sooner if we get some, you know, if we get the debt and the equity lined up over the summer. Some questions around how much we'll be able to do in August, right? I don't know. You guys have any views on that? I mean, this August, we're just not quite sure. Is it going to be a normal August? Are people going to be gone? Are everybody going to be open for business? I mean, last year was a bit of a weird one, right? So let's sort of see how that goes. Burwell shovel ready. I already mentioned, we're waiting for the sort of land situation to stabilize there. But, as I said earlier, our view is that that will get done because it's an empty field and it has much more value as a battery site than it does as an empty field. And so the ultimate buyers of that land will no doubt do a lease with us and we'll move that forward. So again, I don't want to put timelines on that because that's sort of a day-to-day, week-to-week sort of thing. But it seems to be moving in the right direction. Mombari mining lease, as I said earlier, that could be, it's sort of the same thing. It's sort of week to week. You just don't know how long that's going to take to process. And the PNG government seems to sometimes disappear and then all of a sudden throw something on you. That was a little bit how the environmental permit came through. It kind of came through sort of suddenly. So certainly sounds near term, but we don't know. Whoa Gap, again, doing something with this debt. I think we've announced that's in progress. So again, not very far off. I don't want to put a hard deadline on that, but I mean, we've announced that that's playing out behind the scenes and stay tuned on that one. And then I would just say portfolio expansion, especially on the FGS side. I mean, we would like to add additional battery pipeline and additional peaker type pipeline to the FGS portfolio. And so that's always kind of churning away. And as we become a little bit bigger player in the space, more and more people are offering us different things. And we're seeing, frankly, opportunities to partner with different groups. And as I said earlier, the caliber of an Arlington Energy or an Electric Lander, this is really great stuff. And we're very excited by these partnerships and the ability to work together with these guys. So no, we've got, I'd say we have a pretty big list of value inflection events, all in the relative near term. I mean, certainly over the next several months, all of that, we'd like to see some pretty big advancement on part or all of that at some stage.
And obviously just to finish off, Scott, you've got the Dempster, the uranium and vanadium project in the background.
Yeah, we skipped that one. That's right. Yeah, no, that's exactly. That's that sort of cheap and cheerful early stage project up there. We think it obviously thematically it fits quite well. We did some work in August last year that was very positive stuff. And so we've been sort of planning on how we go about moving that forward this year. And that might include a drill campaign. It might include some more sort of exploration to set up for a drill campaign. We're sort of trying to work through those details at the moment. But that has the beauty of being super early stage, relatively cheap. I mean, we're not talking millions of, when it comes to work here and pretty much spot on with our overarching theme, offering investors exposure to vanadium and by extension, vanadium redox flow batteries. So nickel, cobalt and vanadium between the mining projects at this point. And I think we've said before, I think I've said before, we'd love to add some lithium to the mix. And if that becomes possible with the sort of economics and the valuations lining up, then that would probably really complete the exposure that we'd like to give everybody.
Perfect. All right, Mark, have you got anything to to add. I think we've just about covered everything.
No, I've enjoyed that, Scott. Yeah, it's given a nice picture of where you are and what's going on, particularly with the flexible grid solutions as well. So, yeah, it'd be nice to catch up again with you, yeah, in the not too distant future, maybe 2-3 months, and see where you are.
Indeed, we'll make sure and do this more regularly than we have been. We've been, as you can probably see from the news flow we've talked about here, we've been sort of churning away behind the scenes a bit, and I think we're getting to the sort of quote unquote harvesting stage of some of these assets now.
Good.
And so that should give us a good chance to check in with you guys more often.
Excellent. No, I look forward to it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Scott, for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you. Take care,
Scott. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.